Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Tuesday, April 12, 2016. Some of Riek Machar's closest advisors arrive in Juba. And South Sudan insists it is not violating the ceasefire after the U.S. condemns government attacks in Wau County. We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The government of South Sudan is trying to tamp down any expectations of pomp and ceremony when First Vice President-designate Riek Machar arrives in Juba next week. The government says it will receive Machar, not the SPLM-IO. Officials say there will be no press conference or public rally at which Machar will speak, as proposed by SPLM-IO officials. For VOA News, Maguma Davis-Wakarinj reports from Juba.
Government spokesman Michael Makwei says it is unfortunate that the opposition planned an entire program for their leader's arrival. He says it is the responsibility of the government to supervise Riek Machar's arrival.
This irregularity should not be encouraged. If we can start like this, then how will it be when we are in the same government? They are not yet part of this government. Up to that time, when the president, when their vice president takes oath, and after taking oaths and establishment of the Tigono, then they become part of the government. But as of now, they are still IO. And there is no way they would come in and start preparing a program for the first vice president so that he is received at the airport and he is brought to J1 for taking oaths.
Makwei says the office of the president will receive Machar and take him to a hotel where Machar will take a rest.
There will be no public reception of SPLM-IO or SPLM-IO organized event reception. Because SPLM-IO up to this moment is not yet a government to work out its program. The government program for the reception of the first vice president designate shall be as follows. One, the government committee in charge of the reception, accommodation and catering for the members of the SPLM-IO shall be responsible for the reception. The committee will determine other stakeholders, representatives of the political parties, church leaders, and senior government officials that will attend the reception.
The next day, Makwei says, Machar will be taken to the presidential palace, commonly known as J1, where he will be seated beside Vice President James Wani Iga. Makwei says, Mr. Kerr will then greet Machar, and thereafter, he will take the oath of office. In a letter, address the president, Machar requested permission to address a public rally at Dr. John Garang Mausoleum to inform the public about the progress of the implementation of the peace deal. SPLM-IO Information Secretary Mabior Garang Dimabior says such a rally would help unite South Sudanese.
We said that it can be, if the government wants to have a joint rally so that we can disseminate the peace process and give confidence to the people that this peace is real, then we should do a joint press release. But if there's no joint press statement, if according to the proposal of the government, they don't want our chairman to immediately be sworn in, he will just be going for house arrest, just like the G10 went last time.
Makwei says now is not the time for the opposition to start making plans.
The fact that he has now stated that he's coming on the 18th is not yet an assurance. And we really doubt as to whether Riek Machar will be arriving or not. I say this because there is another issue. Of course, as you know very well, these people are fond of creating a lot of stories.
Several obstacles are still blocking the full implementation of the peace deal. President Kerr's creation of 28 states and the disagreement over cantonment areas for SPLM-IO in the greater Bahar al-Ghazal and Equatorial areas remain big stumbling blocks. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rakarinj in Juba.
The U.S. government is condemning recent attacks by South Sudanese government forces, which destroyed a declared opposition cantonment site at Numatina in Wau County. In a statement released yesterday, the U.S. government also condemned recent fighting between the two sides, a clear violation of the ceasefire agreement. The South Sudan Army says it is adhering to the security arrangements put forth in the August peace agreement, while the armed opposition says it was acting in self-defense. Maguma Davis Rakarinj has more from Juba.
The U.S. also accuses Juba of sending more troops and military equipment into Wau. The statement also notes that SPLM-IO forces recently attacked government forces and civilians in the area. The U.S. is calling on both parties to provide access for the ceasefire and transitional security arrangement monitoring mechanism to investigate the circumstances surrounding the attacks. Mabior Garang Di Mabior, the SPLM-IO's Secretary of Information, says some forces loyal to the government ceasefire provisions. South Sudan Army spokesman Brigadier Lur Ruai Kong told journalists in Juba today that the opposition has no presence in the greater Bahar Ghazal and Equatorial regions. He says that government forces have been fighting in two courts criminal elements in the former Western Bahar El Ghazal.
We could comfortably say it is unrealistic for SPLM-IO to accuse us of violations and attacking non-existing sites unless they are implying that they are in secret alliance with those criminals. If there were any military operations conducted, then they must have been directed against those criminals, and I'm referring to bandits and other highway robbers.
Roy insists the SPLA is committed to peace. He says the government has demilitarized the capital ahead of forming the transitional government of national unity.
The troops that were reported to have been brought to Juba are part and parcel of the National Army, and that their movement was a routine administrative matter that had nothing to do with either militarization or demilitarization of Juba.
Roy urges the opposition to work with the government and begin the healing process.
We appeal to SPLA-IO's propaganda machinery to adopt the language of peace and cease making alarming statements.
At the same time, Roy repeated the government's position that it will not allow SPLA-IO cantonment areas in the greater Bahar al-Ghazal and Equatorial regions. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinj in Juba.
The World Bank says economic growth in Africa last year slowed to its lowest level since 2009. The bank's Africa Pulse report says this year's growth will be subdued. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The report says gross domestic product, or GDP growth, averaged 3% in 2015. That's down from 4.5% the year before. Poonam Chuanpol is the World Bank's acting chief economist for the Africa region and the lead author of the Africa Pulse report. She says sub-Saharan Africa faced quite a difficult situation in 2015 with what she calls external headwinds.
Especially the decline in commodity prices and also the slowing down of global growth and tightening of financial markets dampened growth in sub-Saharan Africa.
The plunge in commodity prices included the plummeting price of oil, down 67% from June 2014 to December 2015.
Oil is very important for the region, and it's not just oil, it's also other commodities, metals and minerals, because sub-Saharan Africa is a net exporter of commodities, and there was a dramatic drop in commodity prices, which had implications for export earnings, but also importantly for fiscal revenues.
Such commodities make up the bulk of the region's exports. Paul says domestic problems also added to slower growth.
The domestic conditions are electricity shortages in a number of countries, including South Africa, Zambia, and there was the impact of severe drought in several countries, which impacted agricultural production, for example, in Botswana, which was also hit by a decline in demand for diamonds. In some countries, political uncertainty has affected growth, and in others, it's also security concerns, heightened security concerns.
The World Bank Africa Pulse report also says more countries had fiscal deficits, which piled up debt. Poll says it's been a long time since Africa has seen a growth rate as low as 3%.
It's also very important to note that this low rate was last seen in the region in 2009, when average GDP growth for the region was about the same level. And also, this level is well below the robust growth rates that the region enjoyed in the pre-financial crisis period of 2003-08, when growth averaged about 6.8% a year.
However, there were bright spots on the continent.
Some countries have actually managed to sustain robust levels of growth. For example, Côte d'Ivoire, but also countries like Rwanda and Kenya, Tanzania and Ethiopia.
The report says moderate growth is also expected for Ghana, with improved investor sentiment, new oil fields, and the easing of the electricity crisis. The World Bank's acting chief economist for the Africa region says many countries should undertake structural reforms, including diversifying their economies.
I think that's very important, because we've seen that countries have relied increasingly on commodity exports, and that makes them vulnerable to movements in commodity prices. So diversifying sources of growth would help to build resilience of these countries and find new drivers of growth. And for this, they need to undertake structural reforms that would improve the competitiveness and productivity in the region.
The overall African GDP growth for 2016 is forecast to be just 3.3%. It's expected to improve in 2017-2018 with a growth rate of 4.5%. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Two workers of the Danish Refugee Council have been shot and killed in a road attack in Yei. As we learn from our reporter, Kongu Tito Justin, officials are searching for the unknown gunmen responsible for the attack.
Yesterday, this morning, a number of men attacked several vehicles, including a vehicle belonging to Danish Refugee Council. And they killed two staff belonging to Danish Refugee Council, the mining group.
And how did these two people die? Did they get shot? Were they stabbed? What was the cause of death for these two people?
According to the information they just got, we got here, the dead bodies, their hands had been tied before they had been killed. So now they were gunshot, according to the information. So they were gunshot in the place when the commission was coming, actually.
And also, just to clarify, you said that they attacked a vehicle of the Danish Refugee Council?
Actually, there were several vehicles that had been stopped, and one of them belonged to the Danish Refugee Council. And the two people who had been killed, they said they belong to the Danish Refugee Council. They are in the demining groups.
I see. And do we know if this was a targeted attack or was it random?
As I said before, several cars had been stopped, and including motorbikes, after they had been stopped at random. And this also used to happen every time. As I said before, this is the third time. This unknown gunman used to come by the roadside and stop vehicles and attack also people. So it happened today, which results in the killing of two people.
Could you describe to us what the atmosphere is like right now? Is there still fear lingering around where you are, or have things calmed down?
Right now, what we have this evening is, according to the statement issued by the State Information Minister, he said the governor is actually not happy about what has happened because it has been an off and on attacks in the same place and same place every time. So the governor is not happy. And also they say they have ordered all the security to go to the place and go and assess who are these unknown gunmen, so that they can be arrested and also be taken to the court.
That was Kongu Tito Justin speaking to me earlier from Yei. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. More stories when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions.
question today.
Do you ever eat bushmeat?
When I was growing up, bushmeat was for only men, and I'm a female. And now I'm grown, I can eat it, but it's nowhere. You can't get it in the supermarkets.
No, not as I wish. In my country, we don't eat bushmeat, but as I work in a humanitarian program, you never know in the country you're in what you're eating. So it's not like something that I would not want to wish to eat, but I may have eaten them somewhere and I didn't know.
Yes, of course, I have ate bushmeat back in the days. Just because, you know, those days I was like in the village, I went to see the parents, so it was like I had a chance to have that capability to eat of that kind of meat.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday health segment. Today we are talking about the control of tobacco. The number of adult cigarette smokers worldwide is increasing, particularly in poor countries, despite the adoption of a global treaty on tobacco control. However, one of the framers of that tobacco convention says reductions in smoking and deaths caused by tobacco use are achievable. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
An estimated 740 million adults worldwide use tobacco daily. Since 1980, there's been a 41% rise in the number of men who smoke regularly and a 7% increase among women. In 2005, the World Health Organization adopted the Framework on Tobacco Control, an international treaty calling on countries to take measures to discourage tobacco use. Some 180 countries are signatories, and where there's strong anti-smoking laws, evidence shows tobacco use goes down, according to Laurent Hubert, the executive director of Action on Smoking and Health. Hubert led non-governmental organizations in helping to put together the framework. France is an example of the impact of anti-tobacco measures. Hubert points to the country's adoption of a stiff tax on cigarettes. He says the tax slashed cigarette smoking nearly in half, but it went up again by 7% between 2014 and 2015, when the country failed to adjust the tax to keep pace with inflation.
But it's not, as some people sometimes ask, is this about banning or making the product illegal? And that's not what it's about. It's about regulating the product so we can avoid the large public health impact it has and decrease prevalence of smoking to very low levels.
Tobacco kills 6 million people a year, says Hubert, and 1 billion people are projected to die by the end of the century. The Tobacco Convention has set a goal of reducing cigarette smoking by 30% from 2010 levels by the year 2025. Other anti-smoking actions that have met with success include banning cigarette use in public places and graphic images printed on cigarette packs. Hubert says the pictures showing the health effects of cigarette smoking are most effective in impoverished areas.
They're better understood and they have more impact. And in jurisdictions where you have also an illiterate population, then obviously they also make it much more effective to understand what the message is about. So they are effective.
80% of countries require cigarette packs to display graphic images. But in some countries, like India, factions influenced by big tobacco companies are fighting back, and it's hard to get anti-smoking measures enacted. Hubert is optimistic that the target to reduce cigarette smoking worldwide will be met. Currently, there are no sanctions to enforce the goal of the International Tobacco Treaty, but Hubert says that's the next step, to encourage compliance with the global campaign to end smoking. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
It's day two of a three-day voting referendum in Darfur, but human rights activists in the troubled region say the administrative referendum does not reflect the will of the people. Activist Naja Mansour says the people of Darfur want peace and delivery of basic services.
I started this initiative like a long time ago, since the referendum started to like show up as a decision according to the Doha Agreement. But actually, we started 3 months ago an initiative called Darfurian Referendum is not a Darfurian choice. We aim at reflecting to people the very facts and the strategic reasons why this referendum is to be done. I mean, it's done by the government or is going to be conducted by the government. And we wanted the people to understand exactly what the situation is.
Mansour says the people of Darfur will use the outcome of the vote against them. Students in Al-Fashir University in northern Darfur blocked several streets yesterday to protest against the referendum. Mansour says the students are sending a clear message to the Darfurian population.
There are some students who are quite aware of the situation, and they are trying to get people aware of the nature of the situation. They wanted to remind them that referendum is not the choice of the Darfurians, and that they shouldn't go and they shouldn't vote for in the referendum. Because the thing is, if people go and participate in the referendum by any means, their voices will be used in a way or another.
Abdallah Adam is one of the students from Al-Fashir University. He says they are demonstrating because the referendum has been imposed on the people of Darfur.
We started a demonstration from the Faculty of Education, then we went to the Faculty of Human Resources, after that, to the Faculty of Medicine. We are on the way to the IDs camp and the market to make people aware of the situation and that referendum is not their choice.
The U.S. State Department issued a statement this week questioning the credibility of the exercise. General Alfred Ladu Gord, the deputy chairman of the SPLM-IO, returned to Juba today along with dozens of other opposition officials. Government officials welcomed Gord's arrival, saying it gives hope that the war is finally coming to an end. Waki Simon Mudu has that story for VOA from Juba.
Dressed in a black suit, a white shirt, and a pink tie, Lieutenant General Alfred Ladu Gore emerged from a plane chartered by the Kenyan government. Gore says he came back to Juba to support full implementation of the peace agreement.
Peace will not be reversed. We must move forward with our country. And this is a momentous challenge which we have for us to be together, to work together, to find solutions to the problem.
Gore's arrival comes after last batch of 1,370 SPLA-IO forces arrived in Juba over the weekend as part of transitional security arrangement for Juba town. SPLM-IO spokesman William Ezekiel says Ladu and his delegation are ready to go to work.
We have resolved to be together and to continue with our effort to rebuild this country. It's very important that this country must occupy its place among the free nations of the world.
Akol Paul Akordit, a member of the National Assembly and a member of the SPLM Political Bureau, was the only government official to greet Gore at the airport.
His arrival today signifies that indeed the war has come to an end and that the suffering inflicted on the people of South Sudan by this unwanted war will be brought to an end. And that peace shall reign once again, this
can... Ezekiel says government security agents arrested and detained 16 SPLM-IO officials who were mobilizing civilians to receive Gore at the airport. Gore condemned the arrest, calling them a breach on freedom.
That is unfortunate and should not recur, shouldn't, because peace means our people should be free to talk their minds. Peace means freedom. To express your mind, gather together, to express yourself, even if it means you disagree. But it is very unfortunate incident. I deplore it and I condemn it.
Paul Akordit denies knowing anything about the incident. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
And here in the United States, Sudanese sprinter Ahmed Ali has been making headlines for winning the 200-meter title at the Florida Relays earlier this month. Ahmed ran the race with a world-leading time of 20.16 seconds. The University of Alabama senior is now setting his sights on representing Sudan at the Rio Olympic Games in August. He recently spoke with VOA's Sunny Young and reflected on his emotions following his impressive win.
I was extremely happy and surprised when I saw the clock. I honestly didn't believe it for a second till that time actually stood for a second, and I looked at it again, then I really believed it, and I just ran back and really hugged my coach and let the moment sink in for a moment, and it was surprising.
At the international level, you compete for Sudan, is that correct?
Yes, that's my native country, yes.
Did you get any response from any of your fans in Sudan after that race?
Yes, a lot of love and calls actually regarding that, and them actually telling me that that was the national record for Sudan and stuff like that. And it was a pleasing moment to hear all them fans calling me.
That time at the Florida Relays, I mean, that's a great time, Ahmed. Does that kind of inspire you to maybe make it to Rio for Sudan?
Yes. With that time, it gave me a lot of confidence in myself and knowing where I stand, and actually knowing that I can run that fast now, and I guess able to maintain the level of ability to run that fast week in and week out is what's really going to get me going. And of course, with that time, if I have the ability to run that time again over and over, and I will have a nice chance of actually turning professional.
In terms of the Rio Olympics, Ahmed, I know in the United States they have Olympic trials for athletes hoping to make it to Brazil. What about Sudan? What is the qualifying process like there?
Due to Sudan being a small country, not as big as USA, of course, we don't have a trial. We just have the best athlete they have, but we are still required to get the A standard in order to get to the Olympics. Just like USA are required to get the A standard, we still have the same standard in order to get there. But the only difference is USA has a trial and we don't. So that's a little different, but we still have the same standard.
Did you meet that A standard in the 200 meters with your 20.16?
Yes, the A standard is a 20.50. Yes, I met that, and I met it also last year with a 20.46.
In terms of your training, Ahmed, being an Olympic year, does that maybe add a little extra motivation when you're on the track?
Oh, yes. For every athlete, it does. Knowing that this year doesn't come every year, every 4 year, and not everybody have that chance, and it goes by so fast. It gives you that mentality, this is the year I have to have it all together.
At the international level, when you line up, say, next to somebody like Usain Bolt, what's the feeling like to go up against somebody like that?
It's a nerve-wracking feeling. I feel that way, actually, every time, actually, I get on the track, regardless of who's there or not. It's just a feeling I've been having since I started running track. But once that gun goes off, it goes away. It don't matter who's on the I'm racing next to or whoever, because everybody has their own lane. But I believe actually it's going to be an honor actually be racing against Usain Bolt. I have that honor to be next to him, and not everybody gets to race him.
That's for sure. All right, you're at 20.16 now, Ahmed. Can you dip below 20 seconds?
Yes, I believe I can. With the way I train and trusting myself and trusting my coach and guidance and how everything is going, I believe I can run faster. I want to surprise myself and see how fast my body can run.
That was sprinter and Olympic hopeful Ahmed Ali. He spoke with VOA's Sunny Young on the phone from Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And that's our show for this Tuesday. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. We leave you with the song Limbo by Jimmy Cliff.
Sitting here in limbo, but I know it won't be long. Sitting here in limbo, like a bird without a song. sitting.